Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
Few years we've considered the connections between the gut and the mind. We've considered lectins, we've considered good gut health, good bacteria, bad bacteria, and so on. The one undeniable connection is that there is a link between our feelings in the gut feelings, and the way our general health actually operates. And so we're delighted to actually follow on with this by considering the real science behind gut instincts and more, to speak to psychologist extraordinaire, Dr. Aria Campbell. How are you, Dr. Aria?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you, Alex?
Excellent. And this is something which I think intuitively, on some level, we all tend to say, yeah, of course, you know, if you have certain inputs and certain sort of materials that you're taking in and you're trying to digest them, etc., they may well sort of impact badly, and they can give us all sorts of other elements. I mean, you know, we are what we eat is the old sort of cliche, but there are so many sort of things related to how our gut actually operates, how the bacteria operates, and indeed our sense of well-being, presumably.
Absolutely. And I think that's reflected in the research from Yakult, which found that 92% of us regularly use phrases connected to the gut to describe feelings, you know, with having butterflies in the stomach being the most common, having a gut feeling or gut instinct or feeling gutted. And these phrases like having guts or listening to one's gut have been a part of everyday language for hundreds of years. But we rarely pause to question the basis of our language and our experiences.
So does this also look to connect the oft-mentioned and sometimes regarded as the source of obviously all our good and bad feelings in many ways, the vagus nerve? Is that something which is at the heart of this? I mean, we can almost go back to the Greeks and saying their sort of the concept of being in balance and being a good sense of humour is part of this.
You're spot on. It's you know, whenever we begin to look at that link between why is it that when you feel anxious or stressed or happy or excited that you feel it in your gut, it's because there's biology at work. And I think this is a crucial area because the Yakult research found that while 96% of us admit to following our gut instincts, at least some of the time, nearly half of us don't know that there is this real connection between our gut and our brain. And only 29% of us have heard about the gut-brain axis.
You mentioned obviously having butterflies in the stomach, which is the number one popular phrase that's being used. I see gutted, yeah. Feeling gutted comes in at number three, although with 41% of men versus 47% of women, I suppose if they were England supporters in the recent European Championships, that might have gone up to about 80 or 90% in terms of feeling gutted. But that's another line. On the other hand, presumably, if you were following Italy in any way, shape or form, you would have actually felt very positive about the whole sort of side of things. But let's not talk about sport at this particular time. were you kind of surprised by again some of the findings, or is it just a case of, well, it confirms, and Yakult's work here has kind of confirmed that whole notion of, say, the gut brain axis and this direct connection between the gut and the brain?
I think it lends more credence and validity to exploring the war experiencing but with a scientific lens. And so it can even be helpful if we want to understand it better. You know, our brain communicates with all the organs in our body, and it'll send messages through a network of nerves, a little bit like branches of a tree that spread throughout the body. But the gut is always in close communication with the brain, and they essentially talk to each other on a regular basis. It's bi-directional. And it's this close relationship, this connection, which is the gut-brain axis. And then, so we can ask, if the brain and the gut talk, what language do they speak? And like you were saying, the gut and the brain have a direct physical connection through the vagus nerve, which carries messages back and forth continuously. And the main language is through chemical messengers called neurotransmitters. And we might have heard about dopamine and serotonin. And these are really important brain chemicals, which are often described as happiness or feel-good hormones, since they influence our mood and emotions. And these chemicals are actually produced by the gut and by the trillions of microbes that live in our gut, which are known as the gut microbiota. And so that's why the health and the state of the gut has such a profound impact on the health and state of our brain or our mental state.
Physically, I've always been astounded by the statistics that come out of the size of the small intestine and the duodenum and the way that you can actually literally have half the size of a tennis court or a football pitch or all of those things. Then it seems a phenomenal kind of usage of space and design that all of that fits into place. But let's talk about the mind, because you know, clearly you're co-author of A Mindful Year, the awesome text strip from that point of view. As well as obviously providing useful, assisting good bacteria, are there ways in which that positive mindset can actually also help us focus and sometimes calm the kind of uncertainties that we actually feel by simply focusing on our own behavior?
The mind does have a profound impact on our body, and you know, our physical well-being has an impact on our mental state. You know, we used to separate the mind and the body, but we're now seeing just how closely interlinked, you are. And I think what you're asking about really speaks at the heart of psychology. It's understanding how our thoughts and emotions affect not only our actions, but our physical state. And yes, perspective or outlook or the vantage point that we take on a situation is incredibly powerful. You know, the mind's built with a negativity bias. It tends to lean towards the negative. And the mind's natural state is often to focus on what's missing, what is going wrong, and what we cannot control. And so when we're aware of that, we can begin to shift our mindset towards what's working, what is within our control, and what opportunities could lie now. And that, like you're saying, will have an impact on our level of anxiety, our level of stress, whether or not we feel excitement or we feel overwhelmed.
Does this also tie in with what I believe in the sort of 70s and 80s used to be referred to as biofeedback, in which we can, again, look at using the whole notion. I often say to students who are feeling very anxious about a presentation or a viva or something actually going through, that it sounds very simple, but breathing is just so vital to the whole exercise of maintaining one's calm.
Breathing is probably one of the most simplest, and it can almost seem deceptively simple, but most powerful way to change your physiology. And a little tip is, we know that whenever we lengthen our exhale, so I'll do something called 4-8 breathing, where I might breathe in for 4 seconds and breathe out for 8, and you can press your lips in order to help extend the exhale. That actually activates the vagus nerve, which triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, which essentially brings down your heart rate and lowers your blood pressure. So it's an evidence-based way of changing your physiology. And the beautiful thing about the breath is it's always with you. It can become an anchor to ground yourself in the present moment. So whenever your mind begins to become distracted by what could go wrong in the future or what went wrong in the past, the only moment we truly have is the present moment. And that's why when I work with, you know, sports people or different high-performing individuals, you will perform at your best and experience more calm and ease when you're more present. And the breath can be a gateway to the present moment.
I was particularly taken with the estimation that more than 90% of the serotonin, as you said earlier, the feel-good chemical in our body, is actually produced within the gut. Mm. I think for a lot of folk, people thought, oh, serotonin is all produced in the mind, it's all produced in the brain. No, it's actually in the gut, which is useful. Clearly, I will obviously promote draria.com as a wonderful go-to website to find out more details about your own work, but are there any other websites you'd like to produce or suggest to us in terms of the Yakult survey, Dr. Arya, that maybe people can find out some more about what we've been talking about today?
Yes, they've got a really great and comprehensive short video explaining the gut-brain axis, which is on the Yakult YouTube website, which I definitely check out, or just yakult.co.uk in terms of more information. And with that, people might then begin to explore, okay, if my gut health affects my brain health, how can I look after my gut? And a lot of what we've talked about is part of it helping to lower stress, whether or not that's by walking or running or yoga or meditation, time outdoors in nature, time with your friends and family. These are all simple science-based ways to improve your gut and your brain health and our nutrition too. Because just to add that, greater diversity of microbiota has been linked to better health. So eating a wide range of fiber-rich foods, vegetables, fruit, beans, whole grains, omega-3 fats from oily fish and fermented foods, whether that's dairy products or kimchi or tempeh, can all be science-based ways to improve your gut health. And I think that links to Yakult's wider mission of helping people to be more empowered to look after their health from a holistic point of view.
Absolutely. Although I must admit, again, there are lots of sort of psychologists or nutritionists who are saying that maybe we need to be a bit more wary of some of those whole wheat grains these days. But that's for another debate, another talk. My gut feeling at the start of this piece was it's going to be a good interview. And I'm pleased to see that gut feeling was manifested. But we still have those two final questions to wrap up with. So first of all, Dr. Arya, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
Have I had a relatively interesting
Zoomer? It's the term we use to discuss this new technology we use via the medium of Zoom to actually connect with our interviewees. Has it been okay for you?
Oh, I've absolutely loved it. I feel like I feel like there's been a gut connection between the two of us.
Well, there we are. The vagus nerve is working in simpatico, which is brilliant. So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to return? Will you come back sometime?
If you'll have me back on, I'll be here with the big smile.
Dr. Arya Campbell-Danish, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on, and bye for now.
Thanks, Alex.
Pump it up while your feet are stumping, and the jam is pumping. Look ahead, the crowd is jumping. Pump it up a little more, get the party going on the dance floor. See, 'cause that's where the party's at, and you find out if you do that.
We go. We've just actually been listening to the vagus nerve and the importance of obviously the vagus nerve with Dr. Arya. We've had a whole range of other activities and wondrous joys from, of course, the movie of 1996 with Tektronik. I'll say it again, Tektronik, Pump Up the Jam. What a fantastic thing. You got Bugs Bunny and you got Lola Bunny in there. It's awesome. Truly tremendous and positivity all around as we actually launch into Movies and Royals. Incidentally, for people who are actually using radio as the theatre of the mind, it is indeed Lola and Bugs who are behind me, not Prince Harry and Meghan. Easily confused these days, but I know which two I'd like to have working with us, but never mind. Well, the team is pretty much assembled now. We have from Australia, number 5 lockdown, Natasha Armstrong. How is it for this fifth lockdown for you guys? I mean, we're so envious here. We still haven't got out of really number three. It's free lock day, basically, because obviously it's not really freedom. It's free lock, because that's why the Prime Minister obviously goes into isolation. You'll have heard all this. What's it like in your fifth lockdown then, Natasha?
Hi, yes. Well, we don't know when the end is in sight, so it's a little bit frustrating. I was like, everyone feels the same. Fortunately, I've been distracting myself with the Olympics and Star Wars, so I've been keeping the good vibes going somehow.
Exactly. That's great. And Gabriella Van Genians, how's life in your part of Ipswich, Suffolk land, and so on?
Oh, nothing much is happening here, to be honest. I just feel so sorry for Natasha. I'm so sorry that you're in your fifth lockdown. Like, I feel like we've had five lockdowns, but we've only had three.
Yeah, it's quite pathetic, really. We need to actually get the government to bring on those lockdowns, shut us down straight away. Otherwise, before you know where you have it, you'll have film critics like Richard Fitzwilliams trotting off to see Oliana in the theatre, trotting off to see other theatre performances without a care in the world in any way, shape or form. It's frankly, you know, quite frankly, outrageous. However, never mind. Let us go to Natasha, because I think it's only right that Sebastian Mann also joins us. Hi, Sebastian.
Hi. Hey, sorry, I had to unmute myself.
That's good morning. It's all right. It's always good. Natasha, I'm going to award you the role of, do you want to go down the line of our sports correspondent extraordinaire because he loves the Olympic Games? He's probably glued to them now. I know he loved the European Championships. He's into basketball. He loves the joys of fitness, etc. So Space Jam 2 might be something you wanted to go to. Would you like Richard Fitzwilliams to take us down the line of Oliana, or indeed artistic exhibitions, or indeed a couple of his movies that he suggested? Or is that just nowhere special? I don't know. I mean, would it be The Summer of Soul from 1969 that you prefer? It's entirely up to yourself. Who do you wish to actually go for? What topic would you like them to launch this whole process with first? There is actually one image that Richard Fitzwilliams has also sent me, which is frankly so shocking, I'm having to decide very seriously as to whether I'll put it on. I mean, I thought these rabbits were quite shocking, but the rabbits that Richard Fitzwilliams has in mind, it could be even more amazing in terms of an art exhibition. Who do you wish to go to? What topic would you like them to start off with first? The choice is yours. Lockdown, Natasha.
Firstly, can I just say, Sebastian, I love your haircut. You look fabulous. Secondly, I think I'd like to pick Space Jam purely because my sister has not been back to the cinema since before lockdown happened in the UK. So I'd like to see what Robin has to say to it, because I think it's going to be the film that finally gets her to commit to a cinema ticket. So
A lot, Robin, the floor is now yours. Bump up the jam, dump the jam. Sorry.
I'm loving the little dance that you're doing there. Okay, let me put my cards on the table. I am a committed cartoon fan. I love cartoons. The animated shorts of Warner Brothers, the Looney Tunes, loved them. They were an integral part of my growing up. They were an integral part of the formation of my rather strange sense of humour. The last time we saw the Looney Tunes on the big screen, of course, we had Space Jam 25 years ago, and about 19 years ago, we had Joe Dante's Looney Tunes back in action. Now we have Space Jam, The New Legacy. And I was curious. I was really, really curious because I love these characters. I have devoted more time and more money to buying DVDs of the original cartoons. You would not believe. Sadly, they shouldn't have bothered. That sounds harsh, but I will tell you why. It's kind of a loose reworking of the original Space Jam, but yet it isn't. Yet they refer to it in a self-referential, joking way, and it also steals a couple of plot points from Looney Tunes Back in Action. So we have a basketball champion. I mean, I am not a sports fan, but of course I've heard the name LeBron James, just like I'd heard the name Michael Jordan. I know what they do. He's at the cusp of a a bad relationship with his youngest son, who he wants to become a basketball star like himself, but the son wants to be a games developer. Now, the son joins LeBron James in a meeting at Warner's to discuss possible film projects, and they have an argument again about the son's basketball career, which he doesn't want. And a rogue algorithm has become self-aware, kidnaps the son, kidnaps LeBron James, and basically tells them that they, in order to be freed, they must play a basketball game where the son's self-created basketball video game, that's the basis for the rules, and it'll be populated by cartoon characters. The audience is drawn from real life and Warner Brothers' own cast of characters from various franchises, including Matrix, DC. So in that aspect, it is a little bit like Ready Player One, that the fun is seeing...
Stay on Themyscira! Stay on Themyscira! Stay with Wonder Woman!
We have Kong, we have the Iron Giant. There's a whole cast of characters. So as the film progresses, we get this basketball game, which seems to go on for about 35 minutes. And it's too long. By the time the Looney Tunes characters themselves are introduced, we already have hit the problem that as an actor, LeBron James is a fantastic basketball player. He doesn't seem to have the personality to play a fictionalized version of himself, and he seems unanimated, he seems dull, he seems drab, and he comes across with his sons as rather a boorish bully who said, you know, you will play basketball for a living, it's good enough for me, it's good enough for, you know, it doesn't work. Michael Jordan had a far, far better personality and translated better onto the screen. Now, we have this algorithm who's personified by Don Cheadle. Don Cheadle is a very, very fine actor. I mean, he's usually got a laid-back personality. He's multifaceted. We've loved him as the War Machine in the Marvel films. But here, he chews the scenery like Vincent Price on speed, and it just doesn't work. It's not him. You wish he could dial it down. In fact, the whole thing about the algorithm going rogue seemed to me... You see, one of my problems with this film is the Looney Tunes aren't funny. And that, to me, was crushing. By the time they arrived, I didn't know whether it was the fact that I was jaded by everything I'd seen up to this point, and I expected better, or, what was even more scary to me personally, the fact that at 61 years of age, I had finally grown up and developed some kind of sophistication.
No!
I know! So last night, I actually got Looney Tunes back in action on disc, slipped it into the player, and I thought, okay, is it me or is it the film? That had me on the floor practically laughing, because Joe Dante knew what he was playing with. And a lot of that film kind of went, it didn't resonate at the time, but it resonates now, because they address this film's central problem of political correctness. In Looney Tunes,
is Lola Bunny not up to speed, Robin? Is that what you're saying? No. Is Lola Bunny...
None of them are. You've lost the anarchic sense of humour.
No in Pepe Le Pew? No Pepe Le Pew?
In Looney Tunes Back in Action, you have a scene in the Warner Brothers canteen where Bugs Bunny is having a meeting. It's a bit like, you know, Roger Rabbit, animated and real life. With a studio executive, and she's going through a script and says, right, can't do this, can't do that, can't do this. Oh, and the cross deck, you need a leading lady. Bug says, well, I've always been my own leading lady. And all of a sudden you see him in a full dress with makeup. And said, and that cross-dressing is out. This is the age of political correctness. You can't do that anymore. And all of a sudden he's back to normal, except he's got lipstick, and said, look, lady, If you don't find a rabbit wearing lipstick funny, I have nothing more to say to you. And that is the very encapsulation of what the Looney Tunes were always about, because they were never aimed at children. That didn't come until they were sold to television. They were always aimed at adults. The children could laugh at the graphics, but there were several adult jokes in there. And this is what they've lost. They are now pasteurized. They're not funny.
Oh,
they're
no. Like,
Well,
we'll just have to hold that. Go and see the original Space Jam. It still actually raises
absolutely.
A smile.
Or better yet, watch the original films. This is a chore to get through. And for me to say that about any Looney Tunes enterprise is heartbreaking. I would give this 3. And the only reason I'm giving it 3 is because at least I had fun trying to spot who's in the audience.
Okay, very quickly, Gabriella Vangenians, will you be checking out Space Jam, The Legacy?
To be honest, I don't think I will. Just because I love the first Space Jam. Like, as a kid, the graphics in the film and just everything. And Michael Jordan, I just, like, loved as a kid. But
Bill Murray.
I feel like if I
Bill
watch
Murray.
This... and Bill Murray, of course, yeah. Like, I feel like if I just watch this now, it will just ruin... like everything that I love about the first Space Jam. So
exactly.
I don't think I'll watch it.
Exactly, Gabriella. You've nailed it.
Sebastian Mann, Space Jam 2.
Unfortunately, I have seen it. And yeah, it's terrible. It is a big, long advert for Warner Brothers and nothing more. And it's 2 hours long. Horrible. Hated it.
Wow. Short. And very effective. This is not going to persuade Richard to actually put Space Jam onto his list after Zootropolis, but never mind. Natasha, doesn't look good for your sister.
No, I might have to try and steer her towards Black Widow instead. Rescue them.
Image of rabbits that suddenly sort of appeared behind me there and round and round and round and round, we will actually sort of thank Richard for. Richard, what the heck did you send me this particular image? So backdrops, I love your backdrops. Why do you put this on as a backdrop?
Well, I was introducing the truly remarkable Portuguese artist Paula Rego, and I thought you'd find it rather distinctive because there is an exhibition. In fact, it's got about 100 works, the collages. She used to do those, then she went through an abstract period. She's in her 80s and she's a highly significant figurative painter because she started to take a lot of inspiration from the old masters. And she is, above all, a feminist, someone who, in her native Portugal, for much of her life, it was under the Salazar dictatorship. And one of the aspects of it I thought that you would find interesting are these slightly bizarre rabbits. This was, in fact, based on a photograph that she'd seen, and it was set in the Iraq War, and she thought it was particularly macabre, horrible, and this is the way she makes the statement. She's known most particularly for her extremely disorientating and very often very, very macabre portraits of women. Sometimes the women are in an extremely threatening and very, very frequently, I mean, if you take the maids, for example, are they going to strangle those who they are serving? I mean, there are also various other works which the dog women, for example, would you prefer those? So I thought that, I thought that this was the sort of thing that would draw you in.
It's a fair point, Richard, but really, why haven't these guys actually appeared in Space Jam or indeed Looney Tunes? I mean, surely they should have actually been there. Is it because Warner Brothers just haven't brought them out as yet?
Well, but this is something, I mean, we've been listening to Robin's review on Space Jam, and I mean, it's something, as you correctly say, it's certainly not my cup of tea, but certainly here, if you want something that really will Well, it's disturbing. It's a macabre imagination. This is an artist who, I mean, in Portugal, for example, an extremely conservative country, has had over the various decades the issue of abortion. She's campaigned for it. The first referendum failed. Subsequently, it succeeded. There are a large number of images that I think that they make an indelible mark on those who see them. And I've been absolutely fascinated by seeing the various examples. There's a room dealing with figures of women who are suffering, linked to abortion. There also is the subject of abuse, which he tackles so powerfully. I mean, she's one of the world's top artists, and there's absolutely no question that this is an important exhibition. So I thought, Alex, that you might like perhaps to, it's the ideal, you see, it's on for some months, so you could come down and bring others and possibly explore the show.
Oh, those halcyon pre-pandemic days, we used to do that as a matter of course. Gabriella Vangenians, is this the sort of exhibition which you think, yeah, I can go for that? I like a bit of torture.
Well, I mean, it certainly does look, I can't really tell like from the picture behind you, but like it does certainly look very distinctive. I feel like I might just go and see it, because it is actually like I'm not into torture. Obviously, but I feel like it does actually seem quite interesting and quite unique as well.
Sebastian?
I'm always, I quite like going and see various exhibitions on things, and I wasn't familiar with this artist till Richard just started talking about it. Yeah, I think it's something I would look into learning more about, for sure.
Natasha, they're never going to get this in Australia. It's not going to happen, really. I mean, it'd be banned straight away. Fox News will have enough.
We do have a large interest in art here. We have an art museum, modern art gallery, and it does do a lot of exhibitions, and the tickets are always sold out. So you never know, Melbourne might be a place for it to come and do a bit of a tour.
Or it's seventh lockdown, perhaps. Robin?
Well, what I can see of the picture behind you, I just find it hypnotically macabre. I mean, I'm not saying that I would like the subject matter, you know, abortions and all that, but certainly the style is intriguing.
No, she is a truly phenomenal artist. I hadn't actually ever seen a retrospective before. I'd never seen an exhibition which featured her work. I'd seen quite a few of her paintings and collages and so forth in galleries. I mean, when I was in Lisbon, the president had quite a few of her works in the presidential palace. But I mean, the abortion series, the dog women series, and I mean, this is the macabre, but it's very, very hard to look at some of these works. Equally, her style, and I mean, very, very distinctive. So this is something to enjoy, and also the fact that
then art should be challenging.
It should indeed, and she has certainly had throughout her life. I mean, having been under the Salazar regime for decades, Portugal opened up after the Carnation Revolution in 1974, and I mean, she has therefore spearheaded feminist works, and also there's so much that she's done for feminism in Portugal and also on the world stage, where she is highly respected. So Paula Rego is a name to conjure with, although Alex isn't really shown the work correctly. I mean, he's
blaming my display process. Don't blame me, blame Bill Gates. It's his technology. Let's move on to the definitive account of the experiences, adventures, losses, and life lessons that have helped shape the individual, who together with his wife are indeed described as moralizers who have cultivated grievances into invincible victimhood, now weaponized with a book deal, which could gravely imperil a complacent palace. Natasha, are you looking forward to the first in four wonderful books that have been commissioned by Harry? One which won't be released until Her Majesty's popped her clogs, really. So are we looking forward to this in terms of the next stage further forward for this this fight for freedom?
Well, it's just going and going and going, isn't it, really? It's just one wave after another crashing on the beach. I was actually thinking about you, Richard, today. I was in Woolworths and past the magazine rack, and there was just an absolute spread of magazines with Meghan's Revenge and Secret Christening. And so it's definitely gripping Australia despite the lockdown. I'm sure the book itself will be very popular. It would be interesting to sort of get Harry's perspective. But again, you sort of wonder how much is he living in his own mind and how much of it is sort of true to the events. Obviously, people will always write according to what they believe is true. So, but no, hearing his events would certainly be interesting, and I'm sure it would sell well.
Gabriella, is this going to be one for yourself to actually follow through?
Well, I think I might get the book just to kind of see like what Natasha was saying, like Harry's perspective would be quite interesting. But then again, like it's his truth and perhaps not, it might not be fully true. We don't really know. But yeah, I think I'll check it out. And then I think I saw Richard, actually, I think I saw you in like the Daily Mail or something talking about it, because I was like, oh, like I was wondering like what Richard's opinion on it was. Yeah.
I know, it's shocking, isn't it?
I had several pieces, and one of them was indeed the Mail. But that was when I didn't know that there was supposed to be four. There's some debate about this. But I have to say that the real danger of this, firstly, why tell us all about it now? Because we've got the Queen's Platinum Jubilee to look forward to. And the really sinister aspect of this, if you take a sort of conspiratorial look at the way the Sussexes have behaved since they stepped back, only to step down as senior working royals, and then subsequently, of course, we had the interview on Oprah, the various other interviews, a whole variety of events that show the very, very different perspective that they have to members of the royal family. But what precisely is going to be in this book? Of course, we don't know. The book isn't yet, well, it hasn't finished its first draft, apparently in October. But here's the danger. Anybody, Harry talks about reconciliation and healing, but the trouble is if you say anything to the Sussexes, if you have a chat to Harry and try and bring him on board or whatever, or possibly...
Richard, they're being advised by Barack Obama, Michelle Obama. They've got a whole crack team in the States. They know their PR.
Of course they have, but one of the troubles is whatever you say may appear in the book. So it's, as I see it, and this is the last bit, in fact, I did for The Sun, that I saw it as a sort of possibility and a very real possibility that this might be a lever that they would use against the royal family, as, for example, just before the Sandringham summit, when they wanted to step back and were forced to sit down.
You've got to negotiate. You've got to have the leverage. They knew this in The Godfather, Mario Puzo. It's important. Robin, any final thoughts on this one before we head off to the Summer of Soul?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've read what Richard had said about this being used as leverage. And my own personal opinion, I don't know what Richard will make of this, is he says leverage, I say coercion. They are two sides of exactly the same coin. Now,
gaslighting.
If this little guy is now blackmailing, he's blackmailing the royal family. Why is nobody saying treason here?
Well, I'm afraid that would not be wise. There are several reasons, and one of them is that I'm afraid that it's very, very difficult for the royals to hit back. Because here's the problem.
We have a government.
No, we don't, Robin. Don't be crazy. Yes. Don't be insane. Yeah,
I take that back. I take that back.
Government isn't going to interfere, but what, in point of fact, the royal family simply has to accept. And this was the case after Oprah. I mean, they made so many accusations, not to mention the parts of that interview that we haven't yet seen or parts that were released in America and so forth. All you could do is release a 61-word statement and talk about dealing with matters privately and that some recollections may differ and that some issues...
It's a mess, Richard. It's a mess. And let's go to Sebastian.
Okay, one final thought then, okay? Harry, drive through an underpass. I dare you.
Let's move on, because that's the sort of provocation that only a Welshman could come up with, to be honest. Sebastian, any sort of decision in terms of whether Richard should go for the Summer of Soul, or should he actually go for something much more intriguing in terms of Nowhere Special?
I'm actually quite interested to hear what he made of Summer of Soul, actually, because I was trying to think music documentary is quite interesting.
Summer of Soul, Richard, talk us about this fabulous movie.
Well, indeed it is, but I have to say, I have to admit to everybody that I simply wasn't aware about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival until I saw what must be in The Guardian, as I saw the headline, says it's one of the best documentaries of all time. I mean, this is the full title, Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. I mean, hours of the Harlem Summer Festival, a cultural festival, which lasted on weekends over 6 weeks in 1969, have very, very recently been discovered. I mean, it's quite extraordinary because producer Robert Filament became aware of it, and the original version, the producer's name was Hal Tuchin. I thought very probably because I didn't know of it and because others hadn't discovered it, it might well be rather unsophisticated, or the footage might be bad quality or whatever. No, it is absolutely fantastic. Everybody knows about the music festival of 1969 Woodstock. And I mean, there you had Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Joan Baez. And this was very much Summer of Love. But the interest, especially when they were trying to sell this footage in black music, and also this was very much at a period in 69, which was very, very pivotal in black history in the United States, there was absolutely no interest in this footage at all. And you'll see Stevie Wonder, Mahalia Jackson, Nina Simone, The Fifth Dimension, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Sly and the Family Stone, who also performed at Woodstock, and also Hugh Masekela, B.B. King. I mean, it is absolutely hypnotic. As I say, it directed by Amy Questlove Thompson, and also put together at a very, very significant time now, because the way it's cut, the insight you get into African-American history, the links to BLM, and also you're in the situation looking back at that particular period, you get an insight into what was a very, very fast changing environment with the tragedy of Martin Luther King's death and various aspects of race relations in America that are a great deal, not only relevance to today, but also from a documentary perspective. It's absolutely fascinating. And it's so gripping to watch. So I cannot recommend it enough. I mean, 10 out of 10 for this. I mean, this really also, which is absolutely fascinating, you have some of those who performed, you have interviews with them and looking back and why they performed. And for example, the band The Fifth Dimension, who performed Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In, at the time they felt they weren't black, it was felt they weren't black enough, and this was a chance to reclaim their identity. It was almost totally for African Americans, and it all but vanished, all this footage. And now you have an opportunity, and if you don't see it in the cinema, and I'm afraid people are, have to say this, are not going to the cinema, please see it on the small screen if you can't see it on the wide screen.
So considerably better than Space Jam, New Legacy, then, it would seem. It's all right. Also music in that. I'm just putting that out there. Sebastian, does that jive with your thoughts, or have you not seen it as yet?
I haven't seen it yet, but I think, yeah, I've seen glowing praise from everyone, so I think I'll definitely be checking this out.
Natasha, what about your own views on this? I mean, it doesn't feature the Beatles, who I know you can't stand as a band, but other than that, you know, it seems as though it's all right, musically speaking. I've never forgotten that, Natasha. The shock still resonates from that seminar when indeed Natasha Armstrong said, I can't stand the Beatles.
Yes, I remember saying it in the look on your face. yeah, no, as soon as if it's able, if I'm able to find it on the small screen, I would love to watch it in the meantime. Or if it comes out whenever we get out of this lockdown, I definitely want to see this. Civil rights movement in America is something I've studied a lot. It's something that I'm really interested in. So I think, yeah, this feeds into it wonderfully.
And clearly, Gabriella, ideal for histories of journalism. But of course, you took that and did very well last year. But what about yourself? Is this one that you'd consider?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I've seen like glowing praise from it from absolutely everyone. So I think I'll definitely check it out. And I think it's just such a great opportunity that this actually like survived and everyone's able to see it. So definitely I'll check it out.
From so long ago as well. I mean, the 1960, 1969. I mean, Robin, it's amazing. Anything survived from that. Personally, I think anything that's sort of over 30 should actually sort of just hand our details in now. Anyway, Robin, will you be checking this one out?
Steady on there, Logan's Run. it's all right, Natasha. Don't worry. I have always been more of a Beach Boys fan than a Beatles fan. Summer of Soul, absolutely, it is on my hit list. It may not be in the cinema. I'm going to go and see Old this coming week, and I'm already booked in for Jungle Cruise and Suicide Squad the week after. So possibly a small screen. I'll definitely be seeking out the disc and probably the soundtrack because, pun intended, this is my jam, man.
Well, going to the cinema, as long as you've got a COVID vaccine passport, I suppose that's fine. Or indeed, your every second movement is being tracked by the Chinese government. But maybe it's Nowhere Special. Very briefly, a movie which features James Norton as a 35-year-old window cleaner who's dedicated his life to bringing up his son. Talk to us, Richard, about Nowhere Special, please.
Yes, Alex, I think that this is a lovely, very, very moving, sensible, so sensitive film. It's a very, I mean, there's a dark, there's a painful background because it stars James Norton, who incidentally I think would be another contender. I think he should be on the list to be James Bond one day because I think, again, he has the physicality and he has the charm. Directed, written and produced by Uberto Pasolini and John, 35 years old, he's a window cleaner, and when he discovers that he's dying of terminal cancer, he has to find the right family where he feels his son, Michael, 4 years old, played by Daniel Lamont, where he will be happy. And this is a very, very intelligent, sensitive, well-scripted film. Visually, it's impressive. I liked everything about it. And what's also fascinating is it's rather a study of various aspects of community life because the agencies arrange a variety of families which John can take Michael and visit and see whether or not he thinks that they're suitable and so forth. It's a wonderful opportunity for social satire, especially when we meet the richer ones. Sometimes they're using the idea of adoption as a bit of a showcase. Tension does build up a bit to discover who's going to be chosen. I do have to admit that it's pretty obvious, but nonetheless, very touching, beautifully acted. James Norton was excellent. Daniel Lamont also a very good performance, a wonderful young actor. You know, this is a galaxy of absolutely perfectly chosen performers for and actors for the supporting roles. Bits of it are funny. The emphasis for those who have seen a lot of films about those. About protagonists who have terminal illnesses. The emphasis most particularly isn't on his health. We take that, and from time to time, of course, there's signs and there's references to that. But especially it puts the spotlight on the various individuals that we meet whilst he's Sir John is searching. I loved this film, and I'm glad it's had excellent reviews. And I do 100%, by the way, Alex, on Rotten Tomato. It beat Summer of Soul by 1%. That got 99. So these are really, really good movies, and I just wish more people would go to the cinema to see them. But accepting that that isn't possible, and that many, you know, in the team, it's not possible for them, do catch this really moving, sensitive, a little film. It's an Irish movie, and it's so well cast on the small screen.
And no sign of George Formby when he's cleaning windows in there either, which is a bit of a shocker. Never mind. Natasha, Nowhere Special, one for yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Although I have to admit, I am usually a really bad weeper when it comes to movies, so I will probably be a mess at the end of it and all throughout. I saw the trailer and it was just really beautiful. Daniel Lamont, he's such a gorgeous little boy. So I think it's, and his bond with James is really lovely. You can see that they're a good pairing. So no, I think it would be a beautiful movie and I hope I get to see it.
Robin, Nowhere Special?
I think we can all agree that I have nowhere near the emotional maturity to appreciate something like this.
Gabriella.
Oh, definitely. I think I'll check it out purely for James Norton because I'm just a huge fan of his. And like, fingers crossed he gets James Bond as well because I think he'd be great. But yeah, definitely I'll check it out.
And Sebastian.
I think it sounds definitely like a tearjerker, but pretty enjoyable in its own way.
And if you're looking for a small documentary movie, short movie, around about 25 minutes in length, directed by Stacey Souther, regular midweek drive out, etc., I would say check out Valerie. Robin, you've seen Valerie. Do you want to give a very short sort of précis in terms of the tragic tale of a still living, still existing Hollywood legend, and, of course, her battle against Parkinson's?
Valerie Perrine. I mean, what a late 70s talent she was in Superman, Superman 2, Can't Stop the Music, Lenny. She was nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars, and sadly she has succumbed to Parkinson's disease. Now, this is a 34-minute documentary, as you said, by Stacey Souther, and it's a very revealing look at exactly the devastating effects that Parkinson's has upon you. I thought it was an extremely courageous move on Valerie Perrine's part to agree to this and to fully engage in the project, because her body might be failing, but her mind is still as sharp as ever. But on a personal point of view, I felt at times that I was a voyeur in something that was so deeply personal that I really shouldn't be watching it. But it has certainly increased my awareness in the devastating effects and in this lady's courage. And I could not give it less than a 10 out of 10 for its sure, brutal, unflinching honesty.
And I would agree with that. And that's brought us to the end of the sequence. So Richard Fitzwilliams, Robin Pearce, Natasha Armstrong, Sebastian Mann and Gabriella Vangenians, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and keep watching the movies.